Hello, and welcome to Parenting Help with Vigeo Behavior Consulting. Join us for conversations with experts in the fields of cognitive behavior, mental health, behavior analysis, education, and child psychology. On this podcast, we examine the challenges that parents are facing and share insights and strategies that have helped other parents with similar issues. I'm your host, Katie Palmer. I'm a parenting coach and board-certified behavior analyst. I'm also the owner of Vigeo Behavior Consulting. I am fortunate to be able to engage in conversations with some incredible professionals whose depth and breadth of experience can offer guidance for parents who are looking for new ideas. I hope you find this podcast useful, engaging, and insightful. In this episode of Parenting Help, we have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Diane Hudson about self-compassion in parenting. Dr. Hudson is a behavior analyst and parent coach with 20 years of experience and a background in school psychology and special education. She's worked in schools, community settings, clinics, and homes with people with disabilities ages 2 to 25, helping them build not only their own skills, but also helping the organizations and people that support them become more inclusive and more supportive. Currently, Diane works with neurodivergent kids and their families virtually and in person. You can connect with Diane on Instagram at Dr. Diane Hudson or at her website, advancedbehaviorchange.com. Hello, Diane. It is so wonderful to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Katie, for inviting me. I'm excited to talk with you today and just hopefully give some value to your audience.
Oh, I know you will. I absolutely know you will, having talked to you a little bit before. Can you share with everyone just a little bit about what you do? And then I'll probably ask a similar question to what I ask my guests. What are you seeing quite a bit of in your practice that you think our audience might benefit from hearing your perspective on?
Okay, perfect. So I'm trained as a school psychologist, and I worked in schools for about 15 years. And then I got my board certification as a behavior analyst, primarily because I really wanted to be able to work more closely with kids and families. And that avenue allowed me to do that in a pretty amazing way. So I've been doing that for the past 7 years. And for the past 3 years, I've worked on my own, and I work with kids and teens who are neurodivergent. Most of my clients have autism and or ADHD, and their parents. Worked with in homes, in clinics, community settings, schools, again, and still. And I really wanted to make a shift to focusing a lot more on supporting parents, because what I had found in a more traditional applied behavior analytic instructional setting, like in a when the services are focused on the child, is that the families that I worked with still were encountering some of the same challenges, but didn't have as many tools as they wanted to be able to help support their child. And so I specifically created a practice where I'm working with, my clients are older, like 8 years old and up, so not early intervention. So those fun kids and teens and their families, so that they can build something within their family community that supports everyone a little bit better, not just a focus on the child. And a lot of that starts with supporting the parents.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like the reasons that I shifted into working with parents as well, is that they weren't getting the support that they needed to support their child, who might be getting quite a lot of services outside of the home or even in the home. And parents were asking for help in knowing how to either do what some of the professional services were doing, or just learn how to navigate their own family, because many families have more than one child. You know, there might be two, three, four, five kids in the family, and the context that parents live in is very different than the context in which we might work directly with a child.
Absolutely. And I think that that's why I really love using acceptance and commitment training in my practice, because there is so much of a difference in me going into a family's home and working with a child for 2 hours versus, you know, and having a very structured set of events and activities and ways that we're interacting with one another. Family life is not like that. And so by using ACT, I feel like it really helps parents have tools to learn to be more flexible with themselves about how they show up day to day and how that varies.
Yeah, in any given moment, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the things I love. Moment. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit, if you have a topic like this, is there something that you see across, you know, all the very different family dynamics and individuals that you serve? Is there a commonality, one thing that rises to the top most often in your practice?
Yes. And I think that, again, it stems from the idea that kids are doing the best that they can.
Yeah.
And if you take that a step further, parents and caregivers are doing the best that they can. And
every day, yes.
It looks so different day to day, family to family, home to home within a family, because you add extra extended aunts and uncles and cousins, and all of a sudden dynamics change for neurodivergent kids. And they can be very sensitive to that. So then the parent responds differently. In every single one of those cases, though, those parents, those caregivers are doing the very best that they know how. And always the parents that I'm working with are wanting to know how to do it better or differently. And I think about those two words, particularly the word better in quotes, because I think being comfortable with the ebb and flow of it is really where you can help a parent find their sweet spot in terms of parenting a neurodivergent kid, because it's not the same as parenting a neurotypical kid.
It's not. And how do you coach a parent who might be sharing a story and expressing things to you about what happened in a way that seems like maybe they're being harder on themselves than is useful or workable? How do you coach them into reflecting on that and increasing that flexibility with their own responding?
I try to help them kind of zoom out a little bit. So yeah. In those moments where a parent is just, I did it wrong, I'm never going to get it, I'm not helping my child is really what their fear is, right? Yeah. So helping them to see that the environment and the context matters a lot. And the environment and the context in terms of what is around you in the room, who's with you, what activity are you doing? Was there enough sleep last night? Did anyone get the right amount of protein this morning? You know, all of those things. And also, how is the parent talking to themselves or coaching themselves through this process? If I can give an example. Okay. So I oftentimes I get phone calls from parents who have a child who was recently diagnosed as autistic. And for those parents who maybe have raised, you know, one, two, three, four or more neurotypical kids before, this is like, they're just floored, right? And for them in particular, they have this set of parenting skills that has worked beautifully. You know, they have successful kids who are still in school and they're getting good grades, or they've got friends. And then they have another child who comes along who's struggling academically or doesn't seem to get social cues and seems lonely. And so in those cases, what parents really want is still for their child to achieve those same outcomes, right? They also know, though, that their child's brain operates differently. And so they're not sure how to support their child in having friendships. What do friendships look like if you're autistic? What are some things that you could maybe do differently as a parent to support those friendships and that social initiation? And so in cases like that, I have parents saying, but my expectation is this, you know, my expectation still is that they follow directions. I've never met a parent who has said, it's okay if you don't follow directions. Right?
Right. Yes. Yes. Partly because just going right to safety, it's like when those cars are coming down the street and I say, stop. There's a really important reason that following directions is critical.
Yes, absolutely. And yet they know that their child's brain may not be processing information in the same way. So how do we accommodate? How do we prepare a child for getting a bunch of directions or having to sit quietly for an hour in church or sit in class? How do we get them ready for that? Because that's the expectation. But also, this is a kid with a different brain. So I really see a lot of parents wrestling with the idea that I shouldn't have to make my kid do things exactly as everyone else. And also, I know that if they can get there, life will be easier for them.
Yeah.
So really helping parents to learn how to work best with their child's strengths. But I think another critical important piece of that is how to help parents give themselves a little bit of compassion and grace when they're trying as hard as they can and they just feel like they're hitting a wall.
Yeah. Well, there's an analogy I sometimes use that the journey with our neurotypical children looked one way. We took this road, we took that road, and then we went straight for a while, and then we turned right, and we have a neurodivergent child now, and the journey to get to successful independent life is going to look and feel different for all of us. It doesn't mean it's wrong. And so when parents are feeling, they're talking to me and they're feeling as though they're not getting it right, you know, what did I do wrong? I did something wrong. And they're kind of beating themselves up. That what you said about zooming out and slowing down and saying the learning process is different. It's not better, it's not worse, it's not right, it's not right. It's very different. And so you're learning in parallel with your child. You're learning what works and what doesn't. You're learning how hard to push, and that was too hard. But nobody's given you the manual.
Right.
I love that idea of compassion that you just mentioned.
I think it's extremely important because generally, as Americans, we struggle with being, and this is a really broad statement, but we struggle with being compassionate with ourselves if we make a mistake.
Yes.
And what I know about autistic kids and teens is that despite what a lot of folks might interpret in terms of their ability to notice things and perceive things, they're a very intuitive group of people. And if as a parent, it's difficult to kind of just settle in and relax into parenting and being with your child, your neurodivergent child is going to pick up on that really quickly.
Yes.
And it might not be obvious and visible, But over time, what I've seen is interactions between a parent and a child that can really demonstrate that the two of them are on the same page and they're attending to each other and co-regulating. And then sometimes it can go the other direction, right? Yeah. And the further you get apart, the longer it takes, the more challenging it can be to come together. And that connection is something that I really, with all of my clients, we work to rebuild that if we need to. And then we continue building on it, because without that, it's very hard to have to say no to your child.
Right.
And have them be like, okay, well, this isn't the end of the world.
Right. Can you give me an example? So if I'm a mom of a child who is neurodivergent, and in the past, my experience with my own child is that if I change this routine, which I'm going to have to do today, I know I have to change this routine today. And when we change routines that have worked for us in the past, my child has a massive meltdown, sometimes lasting an hour and sometimes destroying rooms and furniture and things flying off shelves and such. So I'm in this situation where I'm anticipating, because I have to make this change as a parent. Something in our lives is dictating this change has got to happen. And I believe my child is going to have a massive meltdown. Can you help me through the moment of, oh goodness, I have to make this change. My daughter perhaps is going to lose it. We're going to have meltdowns. We're not going to get where we're going on time. My partner's going to be upset. My other children are going to be upset. And I'm already in my head in those places. How can you help me with that?
So it sounds to me like you have already created in your head the script and the images that go along in this movie. And it's pretty predictable.
I've seen it before, right?
Yeah. You've seen it before. And you know how sometimes when you see movies multiple times, it's kind of like you can start to do a second or third thing while you're watching it because it's not as impactful, right? And so it's probably likely that this sequence of events will play out, right? And our job is then to prep and prepare for that as much as we can. And one of the things about movies that play on repeat is that they kind of, like I said, start to fade into the background. And so if you can take the idea of, this is my movie script, this is what's going to happen, but I've seen this a lot of times, and so I'm not going to get as wrapped up in it. I'm not going to put as much pressure on myself about not getting places on time, my partner being upset. And this is not like something that you just wake up one day and start doing.
Right. This takes a lot of practice and a lot of awareness. Yeah.
It takes practice. Yeah. Right. But ahead of all the things that you've done, so you've prepared your daughter, you maybe have a visual schedule of the day's events, or maybe you just have, you've verbally said, okay, we're going to have a change here. You've identified activities that will help her be more calm ahead of time, and you're implementing those, right? You've set the day up as best you can. Then the next step is for you to provide as much support for your child as possible, and also at the same time, kind of take yourself out of that mix. The more that you can be a support without letting your frustration about timing, activities, level of noise,
other people's perceptions
interfere.
Yeah.
The better you're going to be able to support your child in that moment. And that, for all the parents I work with, is what they want to do. Like on the outside, they're thinking, oh, what are people going to think? But really, their primary value in this moment is, I need to help my kid feel better.
Yes.
And kind of keeping that value in the back of your mind as this movie script is playing out can help you to make some of those moment-to-moment decisions where you can decide, am I going to get caught up in the script and, you know, kind of drive everything, amp everything up a little bit? Or am I going to step back like I'm watching the movie, I'm just watching it, I'm not involved in it. And I then can focus more on my child in front of me and helping them.
Yes, and I love what you said a moment ago of, or perhaps it was my interpretation because I think this way, but that idea of helping our child does not always mean we're going to remove the difficulty. Because you then said the movie script is going to play out. And I'm here as you need me to support you in navigating the difficulties of this meltdown that you might be having or this tantrum. And it's not my tantrum. I'm not in it with you. I'm here next to you. I'm not in it with you. And I love that distinction that I interpret in what you've said.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think, and that's an accurate interpretation.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Yeah. As I just think about too, you know, myself as a parent, when I know that I'm going to try to approach something with my child a little bit differently, even I, you know, with training and experience and practice, think to myself, I don't really want to do it because it's going to be harder.
Yeah.
And the fallout afterward, I don't want to have to deal with. But yeah. I'll be darned if I do it the first time and it stinks, it's terrible, it's really hard. But I know that in the end, I'm getting my daughter to a place where I really want her to feel more independent and successful and confident.
Yeah.
And then I do it the second time and it stinks a little bit less. And then the third time, I've noticed myself in my own body feeling like, oh, this feels much more natural. And that is where that practice and support from someone who can keep you moving forward can be really helpful.
Yeah.
Because it's really easy to just keep doing the same thing that you're used to, that your child's used to.
Yes. The sort of short-term easier at the expense of the long-term success. Mm-hmm. And not always, but that a little bit. Mm-hmm. One thing that you mentioned a little while ago that stuck out for me because of some of my work recently with several of my families that I work with, we've been talking a lot about rules. And you mentioned expectations, the ways we expect our child to behave, whether that's the ways we want them to or the ways that we expect them to in certain situations based on our experience. But this idea of what rules do we have for ourselves as parents, like I should be a good parent or I should know how to handle this or I should be able to teach my child everything they need to know. Those are fascinating rules that I have heard in my own head. I'm an expert. I should be able to do this. I absolutely fall on my face. Or how do you work with parents and those rules that they may not realize are getting in their own way?
Again, one of my favorite things is to take a few steps back.
Yeah.
And when it comes to rules, I wonder, like, a couple of things. Who is it really benefiting if your child follows that rule? Who's really not going to care if they don't? And what are the long-term consequences of them following the rule or not following the rule? Or in the case of an autistic child or a child with ADHD whose brain is like just flying forward at, you know, a million miles an hour, what if they followed the rule and it looked differently?
Mm-hmm.
Would that be okay? For a lot of us, you know, we grew up in homes with rules that were very clear and lines we did not cross. And I mean, I grew up in the 80s. So, although there was also like that whole like run around until dark and then show up at home sort of thing of the 80s. But, but even still, you know, there wasn't a lot of leeway. Like, you go to school, you get good grades, you are kind to everyone. But those rules don't always serve everyone in every single context. And so as a parent, that's something that I've had to adjust my own perception of. I was raised with these rules, but do these rules really apply? And generally, yeah, I'd want my kid to be kind. I want her to go to school and follow through. I also know that sometimes you have to stand up for yourself. And people are going to see you as unkind. But if you need to advocate for yourself, that's what you need to do, you know? So thinking about the rules that you might have as a family or as a parent, who are they serving and to what end? And it can be a really difficult, messy thought process and discussion, that's for sure, especially if there are caregivers who have different perspectives.
I also think about that interpretation of, for instance, let's take, you know, be kind. Like that's really, it's one of my values is be kind to others. And in the same breath, I will say that I am not kind. If someone is hurting someone else, I am in there. And so my interpretation of kindness might be not as a blanket statement with no boundaries, but be kind to others and take care of those who can't take care of themselves. And I guess I'm sort of thinking out loud right now, but I think about how do we apply a very big, broad rule flexibly in different situations. And, you know, as a thoughtful adult with some skills on tracking my own behavior, like, okay, I can sort of puzzle all that out. But for kids who are neurodivergent, who have a hard time learning social cues to begin with, and when we layer on these rules that maybe are unspoken in society, especially things like when the teacher's talking, you turn and look and listen. That's actually not explicitly talked about very often.
Right. And for someone who's not picking up on what everyone else is doing, or if they're involved in a project that they're working on, following that rule or not following that rule becomes a, you know, something that that particular child can become known for.
Right. Yes.
Not always in a good way.
Yeah.
And then I wonder, you know, I think that a lot of teachers, at least when I look at the beginning of my career in education to kind of when I finished being in schools most of the time, there was a huge shift in terms of being more accommodating and making space for kids. Like perhaps the best example would be kids who have a real big need for movement. And then wiggle chairs came into play. And I've sat on some chairs where I almost fall down, but I guarantee there are kids that do not. And I've seen kids like get on an exercise ball and bounce from one side of a really big room to another while like pushing the ball forward, and they land on it in the center every single time. There's no way I could do that. But those kids at the same time, while they don't look like they're quote unquote paying attention, they hear everything.
They hear everything. Yes. Yes. And on their journey across the room, you could ask them a question. They could answer it. Right. But that's
yeah.
And that's how we know, really. We check in. It's like, you know, tell me one of the three ways I just described, you know, a square. And then I have this fantastic image in my head now of a child like bouncing across the room and saying, four sides.
Yeah.
Sides are equal.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love it.
Four right angles. Yeah. Absolutely. And so I think that there are obvious examples like that, right? Where you can make accommodations and it fits that neurodivergent child's need. And there are also the more subtle, you know, examples when you're raising a child, you're parenting and trying to help your child learn that they can't just refuse to do things, right? There are things that you have to do in life. But then you're not going to let them, you know, they're not going to be bouncing around the room saying, no, I'm not going to. How do you shape and how do you help them learn that? Okay, maybe now isn't the time that you're going to do X, Y, or Z. What can you do? You can ask, hey, can I do this first and then that? You know, helping them to initiate some of those accommodations for themselves is what is really going to help when they get into, when they have a job, when they're in college, you know,
yeah.
So that they understand their own needs and can advocate for them.
And I love that thought process of not just this moment now in first or second grade, but also the self-advocacy later within a context where, yeah, I can absolutely get that done. It may, you know, we've got a week to get this project done. I will likely get it all done on the last moment, but it will get done and it will get done well. You know, if I'm someone who has ADHD and I work better under that pressure. So, you know, please don't set micro deadlines for me along the way, but I will meet the deadline that you've asked me to do. You know, can we work with that? That type of advocacy takes a lot of effort to learn, have the self-awareness, to have adults around you as you're growing up supporting you and listening and taking the time to listen while you learn to self-advocate. And honestly, to tolerate the meltdowns or the tantrums that happen while a child is figuring out what it is they need.
Right.
Because those are going to happen. I guess some of the things that I like to encourage parents and teachers to do is just normalize big feelings. They're big feelings. Our boundaries about don't hurt people. And we may have to fix things if we break them, but it's big feelings. Let's see how we can help you navigate those.
Right. And I think that's one thing that can be trickier for a parent if you yourself are neurotypical and your child is neurodivergent, perhaps sometimes you might feel like your child's reaction to something is so much bigger than it quote unquote needs to be.
Yeah.
However, for their own personal internal regulation system, it is that big of a deal, right?
Yep.
And so, you know, acknowledging big feelings and our response as a parent to those big feelings. If we come in and try to insist that it's not that big of a deal,
yeah,
that can really kind of be, that can be very confusing to a child, right? Because they're thinking it is this big of a deal.
Yeah.
But as a parent, you've got that broader perspective. You're like, well, okay, you're not having chocolate, you're having vanilla. It's not like the end, right? Like, it's not the end of the world is what we parents like to say. But in that moment, it feels like it is.
Yeah.
And yep. Really kind of noticing that as a parent, what taking that perspective, trying to put yourself in your child's shoes, like, yeah, that is a big deal. And then just reflecting that back. That is, you're really sad and mad about having to have vanilla instead of chocolate ice cream. I can tell.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it takes a little bit to get over it, and that's okay. And I'm here.
Yes. I love what you just said for so many reasons, but one of them is there's a way to validate a child's big feelings or reaction to something that we may not have ourselves without being condescending. And you did it really well just then. If we're always telling the child we understand, like, oh, I get it. Well, we don't have to get it, but we can listen and we can ask questions. I can see you're really upset. Do you need something? How can I help you? I know there isn't any chocolate, but is there something I can do for you? I don't need to tell them I feel the same way or I understand their feeling in order to support them and allow them to recognize that their feelings are just as valid as my lack of emotion about the ice cream flavor.
Right.
So thank you for that.
I mean, yeah. And I'm just sort of playing this out in my head. So, you know, you say to your child, I understand. And they're like, you don't understand. And they're probably right.
They're probably right, because clearly you're not throwing a fit right now. So how do you understand?
Right.
How do you understand?
What do you mean you understand? Yeah, you don't get this. And I think that, you know, those things happen too in parent-child dynamics. Like, you know, as we've both talked about, you know, like even as professionals, we'll have days where we're like, whoa, that did not at all go on anybody's part the way that I thought it would. But how am I going to do it differently? And how am I going to fix what just happened? Not fix and put a pretty bow on it and pretend like it didn't happen, but how do I come back and when we were talking earlier, you know, you mentioned repair. How do I repair this with this particular child? And as an adult, that can feel really like we're giving away power, right? Because we're the adult and we should be able to control and manage. And that's not how people work. That's not how humans work.
No.
People don't like to be controlled. Managed.
No, and I was
even
sharing with
4 years old.
Two even I was sharing with a client recently that it is really wonderful when we can, as parents, model that we've made a mistake and we are seeking a way to repair for that or learn from it, that we don't always get it right. And when we can model curiosity, like I don't understand what you're going through right now. I would like to. Can you tell me anything about it? And that genuine, it's got to be genuine, right? You can't fake this stuff. You've got to really want to know and be willing to not have the answers. And that is so powerful, because then your kids are like, oh, well, I feel right now like I want to destroy the entire house. So glad you're not doing that. That is big.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And as kids get older, I think I just want to leave. I don't want to be here anymore. I want to run away. You know, I've worked with teenagers who, I mean, just being able to say that out loud instead of hightailing it out the front door.
Yes.
That's huge. It puts you as a parent and a caregiver or a provider even in another set of uncomfortable feelings and situations, but so much closer to your end goal of self-advocacy, problem solving, you know, independent decision making that's safe.
Yes. Discovery of values. So,
Yep. All the way back to those, you know, what do you really want for your child?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, what a wonderful, wonderful wrap up that was. I love that. And this conversation, I literally just looked at the clock and realized that this, as expected, this conversation just flowed and I was completely engaged and lost all track of time. And There's so much wisdom. You've just dropped so much wisdom and wonderful thought nuggets for us to consider.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and just this conversation has been great. I could keep going on for like another 3 hours.
I know, me too. Well, you know, what I might do, here's something I might do, is have a group podcast where we have, and it'll be extended, it will be a longer one, but it'll have like four or five people talking at once, maybe get everybody in the same room. And so that would just be fantastic to listen to and just hear the wisdom and ideas and humility. You know, I find that practitioners of ACT have a wonderful humility, because we don't always get it right, as we were mentioning before.
Right. And I think that when you're parenting is the place to work from. It is uncomfortable at times, but it is the place to work from, and your child notices it.
Yes. Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you, Katie. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us. Please consider checking out the website www.vigiobx.com to find more helpful resources from our guests and from other professionals using acceptance and commitment training to support parents and children. You can leave comments or requests on the podcast page, find more information about our guests, and subscribe to our newsletter as well. We have a recommended book list, a blog, and options for a free 30-minute consultation if you're interested in working with us. Go gently and have a great day.